United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this honorable court.
Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Rader. Is the defense ready to proceed? Please do so.
May it please the court. Lieutenant Colonel Frank Levy, I, on behalf of Lieutenant Colonel Mark Strickland, represent the appellate in this matter, Airman Jason Rader. The government and the defense actually agree on much in this case. The facts, the law, for the most part, are in agreement with. What we disagree with is we feel that the military judge erred as a matter of law and found facts that were clearly erroneous. Is when Airman Davis, Airman Rader's roommate, who consented to the search and the seizure of the computer, when his unlimited access to the computer and all of its files, then that which is what OSI based their consent, the consensual search.
By framing it that way, are you saying the test is unlimited access versus joint custody or common access or some other thing? No. Are you trying to, in your statement of the facts, implicitly indicate that that's also the test, the legal test?
No, Your Honor, but the military judge and OSI, at least from reading the record, that is what they, at least at the hearing when the motion to suppress, seized on as the rationale of why this consensual search was legal.
The military judge made a number of findings and facts and conclusions of law. So, I don't think that his decision in this case rested on a single factor, which is what you seem to suggest.
Well, Your Honor, the findings of fact number 5, record at 78 and 79, the military judge specifically found in the last sentence that Airman Davis believed that each of the roommates could access all the files on the other roommate's computer via the LAN. Now,
that was one factor among many, though.
Yes, but none of the other factors that he articulated reaches the necessary authority, the common access, to grant the consent for the search.
Let's talk about reasonable expectation of privacy. Why having granted access to any portion of the computer and not having delimited or denied specifically access to other portions of the computer, did your client have any reasonable expectation of privacy in his computer vis-a-vis Airman Davis at all?
Well, Your Honor, there's testimony during the motion hearing from both Airman Davis and Airman Rader that discusses a common practice among the three roommates that shared the apartment, where they would request permission, but they, before they would access each other's files to search for music or whatever they were searching for, they would let each other know and would not do so without the other roommate saying that was fine with them. We're not asserting there were any kind of password protections or anything like that, because there weren't. But it was a common practice among the roommates to respect one another's privacy in that they're not going to go download a file via the LAN because they had access to certain files via the LAN without requesting permission. Now,
before you leave that, is that something that's a statement of fact in the record upon which all of the participants agreed?
It was.
Did Davis testify that that was his understanding of the practice in the room?
No, Davis testified that on the record of 25, that agreements would always, right at the top, they would, I would never go there and take files without first asking them. They said that, the roommates always said they could, but that kind of like, you know, can I borrow a car? Sure, you're never going to say no to your friend who kind of run down to the store with your car, but you'd always ask. And that, what we're suggesting is that the atmosphere, the environment among these three roommates did create an expectation of privacy in their files, in that the roommates weren't just going in.
On the particular day, was permission given for Davis to access the thing for maintenance? What's the record reflect?
Yes, the record does reflect that actually Airman Rader had requested that Airman Davis go in and perform some of the routine maintenance that he normally would do.
So as a matter of fact, you agree, I don't know whether you have to agree with anyone, you would say that the fact that day is that he had permission, at least to the extent that it traveled to maintenance.
Yes, Your Honor. And that is, herein was a problem with that access, because, and this comes directly from Airman Davis's testimony, that he would do the routine maintenance, like the scan disk, disk defrag, those kind of maintenance type things that don't require accessing the folder, individual folders.
Counsel, why isn't this case controlled by the reasoning in Frazier versus Cup? Are you familiar with that case?
No, I'm not.
Okay, you might want to look at it. It's 80. It's 394 U.S. 740.
Okay.
And that was a case where an individual, I'll give you the facts of the case and you can tell me why you would distinguish it, which is as relevant to this particular point. The petitioner in that case had a bag. He shared the bag with his brother or his cousin. The cousin gave consent for the bag to be searched. The petitioner's argument was he only had authority, or he only had access to part of the bag, not the whole bag. And the Supreme Court said, we're not going to engage in metaphysical subtleties. As soon as he gave him access to part of the bag, he assumed the risk that he would consent to, that he would look in the bag and let others look in the bag. So tell me how that's any different from this case, other than that it's a computer instead of a bag.
We would have to get into, in that case, the expectation of privacy that was relinquished by giving up the bag. Here, what Airman Rader did in terms of giving up certain of his expectation of privacy in his computer with respect to Airman Davis was allow files to be accessed via the LAN and allow Airman Davis to perform maintenance on his computer. Now, there's testimony from Airman Davis that he did not need to access the My Music folder, which is where the images were discovered, in order to perform the maintenance. There's also evidence from Airman Rader that, as well as Airman Davis to some degree, that the My Music folder was not accessible via the LAN. And that's a key point here.
Are there any findings of fact that the military judge made that you argue are clearly erroneous, and if so, why? Which ones and why?
It would have to be finding of fact number 5, that the files could be accessed via the LAN.
And do you agree that
it couldn't be?
Do you agree that the other findings of fact were correct, or at least were not clearly erroneous?
There's nothing that's incorrect about the other ones other than that one portion. The problem is they're incomplete. What's missing is a finding of fact that there were certain limitations.
Consul, if I could follow up on that for a minute. In finding of fact number 2, at the end on page 78, it says that on the day Airman Davis found the alleged child pornography, the accused had explicit authority or explicitly authorized Airman Davis to access the computer. And the first findings of fact on that page, the court adopt paragraphs 1-7 of Appellate Exhibit 3. And when we go to that document, on paragraph 6, it says, while recovering for surgery, Airman First Class Davis, without the permission of accused, started using the accused's computers. Now, is that a conflict, and are parties in agreement as to what that means? Which one of those do we look at?
I think the court, you pointed out correctly that in finding of fact number two, he was given permission to access the computer to perform maintenance alone, not to just go searching through the files as he pleased. And I think that's really what is in essence the true issue here. It either falls one way or the other.
So are those two findings in conflict? I guess that's my question. And can we reconcile them? Are the parties in agreement as to whether or not they seem to me that they may be in conflict, and I just want to clarify as to whether or not that is a issue of contention amongst the parties.
Well,
in your view, did Airman Davis have permission of the accused?
Airman Davis had permission to perform maintenance.
Of the computer.
On the computer. And if paragraph 6 means that he didn't call up Airman later and say, hey, I'm going to open my music folder and see what's in there, well, then that's...
So he had a general authority.
I don't think that we can come up here and argue that he did not have authority.
Was the music folder specially passworded or anything?
No, Your Honor. There was no password. My music folder is unique in that it was not accessible via the LAN. And from my understanding of the way the LAN was set up by Airman Davis...
When you do maintenance, do you do it on the LAN or where do you do your maintenance?
No, Your Honor. In order to do the maintenance, Airman Davis would have to turn on Airman Radio's computer, go into...
So if he's on the computer during the maintenance, and that's the point of access, what's the LAN have to do with this?
Well, the LAN...
Other than you pushing that as a clearly erroneous finding, but... You still have to deal with the fact that he's on the computer doing maintenance.
Right. I think the question becomes, how is Airman Davis accessing the My Music folder? He can do it a couple different ways. Can he do it via the LAN? No, because it's not accessible via the LAN. The permissions were not set up to do that.
Okay, but we're talking about a computer that's in Airman Davis's room, right?
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
And a computer that he had access to the computer via permission from your client, right?
Yes.
So what does the LAN add to Airman Davis's authority to access a computer?
Because it all comes back to when OSI decides to take the route of third-party consent to do the search, they take that consent and that authority based on what authority that individual has. Now, if they had gone and said, Airman Davis, we'd like to search Airman Rader's computer, and Airman Davis says, well, I can access certain files via the LAN, and they say, great, let's go do that. They turn on Airman Davis's computer and access Airman Rader's files via the LAN. We have a very different scenario here. And what I'm suggesting is that Airman Davis had certain limits. It wasn't unlimited, and he had access via the LAN. But that doesn't cover and get to every single file on Airman Davis's computer. He could do maintenance. But again, the maintenance doesn't get to every file on the LAN unless Airman Davis oversteps his bounds, which is what he did here. And he can overstep those bounds and invade Airman Rader's privacy, even though Airman Rader doesn't have a password on it. Airman Rader didn't say, don't ever go into my computer and look at the files. There was a tacit understanding among them, right? And that is in the record. It comes out from the record when you look at it as a whole.
The expectation of privacy has to be a reasonable one.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. This machine is sitting in Davis's room. Davis has explicit permission to access it, go on it, at least for certain purposes. Davis, at the time of the incident, had some sort of property interest in it because your client hadn't paid for the whole thing.
Yes, Your
Honor. You speak in terms of tacit understandings and atmospheres. It almost sounds like penumbras and emanations. This is awfully attenuated, isn't it?
Well,
your client's reasonable expectation of privacy, that's awfully attenuated under these facts, isn't it?
We maintain that if Lance Cooper Long in the U.S. v. Long case had a reasonable expectation of privacy in her email records on a Marine Corps, headquarters Marine Corps server, then certainly Airman Rader's reasonable expectation of privacy in the files that were not on the LAN would be reasonable.
Referring to Long, didn't this court expressly refer to the testimony of the network administrator saying that the government had granted the expectation of privacy in that case?
Yes, Your Honor.
And where is the grant here of an expectation of privacy by anyone in authority?
Well, in terms of a personal computer, I think the default would be that you have privacy. There's a reasonable expectation of privacy in all of your files, and you're going to give up certain of those, of that expectation of privacy, if you will, for whatever reason.
Well, let's turn back to finding five, which is where you started your argument. You've suggested there's something erroneous about finding five. In finding five, the military judge said, while Airman Davis had never used the LAN to access the accused My Music file, Airman Davis believed that each of the roommates could access all of the files on the other roommates' computers via the LAN. Now, is the problem there that Airman Davis's belief is incorrect, either that he didn't have that authority from the appellant in this case, or that as a matter of fact, he could not access the My Music file via the LAN? What's the specific problem with the finding that the judge made there?
Airman Davis did not believe that each of the roommates could access all of the files. It was not all of the files. All of the files were not accessible via the LAN. Airman Davis set up the LAN. He knew that certain files were not accessible via the LAN. They would, and the My Music folder, Airman Davis said that he believed the My Music folder was not accessible, and Airman Rader testified that it was not accessible.
Because of action that he had taken subsequent to Davis initially setting up the LAN, correct?
Well,
when he replaced the hard drive, didn't he modify things so that certain files may not have been accessible via the LAN without telling his roommates about that fact?
Well, he had set up, Airman Davis installed the new hard drive for him, and Airman Rader did not set whatever permissions were necessary for the My Music folder to allow them to be accessible via the LAN.
Getting to what is incorrect about the judge's finding, is the judge is not stating in his finding that Davis could in fact access all the files via the LAN. Rather, he's stating that Davis believed that he could access all the files via the LAN. And my understanding of why that's important is what was Davis's belief as to the scope of his authority to grant consent at that time, and the reasonableness of the reliance of the authorizing officials upon that belief. What's incorrect? Is Davis's belief incorrect, or is the judge's statement that Davis believed this incorrect?
The judge's statement that Davis believed that. I don't think Davis's testimony supports a finding of fact that Davis believed he could access all of the files via the LAN. And in fact, I think what's missing is a following statement of fact completing that paragraph that says, when my music folder was not accessible via the LAN.
And where in the record did Davis say that he could not access the My Music folder via the LAN? In other words, if the judge's finding is wrong, that Davis didn't believe this, where does the record show that Davis did not, in fact, believe this?
Again, in Rader's testimony, on page 51...
Not interested in Rader's testimony here, Davis's testimony, because we're talking about the judge's reference to Davis's belief. And I will be interested in Rader's testimony after you answer my particular question.
In the record of page 28, in Bruce Ross' examination of Aaron Davis, he says that, do you know if my music folder was accessible via the LAN? Not that I remember, sir. So it's possible the file could not have the permission for you to access it on your computer. Yes, sir, it's possible. It's not a definitive statement that says no, there is no, but when you take that response to cross-examination and Aaron Rader's testimony, which is not controverted by any other testimony, that the permissions granted in the Monolithic folder did not allow access from the LAN. The conclusion of, or the fact, that the final fact that you reach is that all the files were not accessible.
So your real legal beef here, if I understand it correctly from your start point, was that while there may have been access, there was not common access, and that he didn't have actual access to all the same stuff.
Yes, Your Honor.
Not common in that sense.
Yes, Your Honor. And in choosing to go the route that they could have easily gone downtown and gotten a search warrant here. I mean, LSI set this path in motion by deciding to go with the consent.
That's a different argument. Is there anything in the record indicating this is a removable hard drive?
No, this was a hard drive installed in the computer. There was actually, they also seized a second hard drive that I guess was the original hard drive that crashed, and which is the reason they moved the computer into Aaron Davis's room to begin with. And I don't know if there's any evidence obtained from that hard drive. But Aaron Rader, there was a lot of discussion with the consent for the seizure and then the search of the computer here, that it had to do with the proprietary interest, that it, because Aaron Davis was stolen money, that's what gave, really was the reason they could just go in and seize the computer and then search it.
What role does property law play in our analysis?
It, the Supreme Court has said Maxwell doesn't play. It would have no bearing on whether somebody could consent or not. It's a common usage and the access.
How does that play in, though, to the belief or expectation of the officers involved, who may not be trained technically, but we're looking for a good faith impression that they have?
Well, in order to avail themselves to the good faith reliance doctrine, the reliance must, it turns out to be a faulty one, must be only a factual mistake, not a legal mistake or conclusion. And what happened here is, if they're operating in the belief that Aaron Davis did have a proprietary interest, so there was a mistake of fact that way. He was owed money. But that is not what gives him the right to consent to the seizure and then the search of his computer. It would have to be enough of the common access. And the law enforcement here, including the chief of the military justice from the SJA's office, based it on a faulty conclusion of law that property interest is what really gave him the right to access. And then later, there was a loan, he did maintenance, and they had the land.
Counsel, I have two real quick questions. First, is there anywhere in the record that you can point to where there's evidence that your client specifically said, don't go into this particular part of my computer?
No.
And second, did Airman Davis have, did he have another computer that he used in the apartment, or was the only computer that he used your client's?
Oh, no, Your Honor. Airman Davis had his main computer, and I think he even testified that it was the fastest, and he would always access the Internet and the LAN via his computer. The only reason he ever went into Airman Davis's computer was to perform the scan disk defrag maintenance. I think he felt, since he sold it to him, he had some obligation to.
So in Airman Davis's room in this apartment, there was two computers?
There were actually three. There were two computers in Airman Davis's room right next to each other. And then Airman Thacker, the third roommate, had his own computer in his room. And Airman Davis did not perform maintenance on that. But they were literally on the floor next to each other. Your Honor, I am out of time. If there are no further questions,
you'll have an opportunity on rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Colonel Jerry Barbarous, and I have the privilege, along with Major Matt Ward, of representing the United States Air Force in this case. The military judge did not abuse his discretion when he denied the motion to suppress the child pornography and bestiology images found on the appellant's computer. The military judge's findings of facts were well supported in the record and were not clearly erroneous. His conclusions of law were proper and not based on an erroneous view of the law. As such, his ruling should be upheld and the appellant's conviction should be affirmed. It's the government's position that A1C Davis, the appellant's roommate, had actual authority to consent to the search of the appellant's computer under the Supreme Court's Matlock case, and that even so, the investigators in this case reasonably relied upon A1C Davis's apparent authority to consent to the search under the Supreme Court's Rodriguez case and this court's Wright opinion. If I may address the facts concerning his actual authority to consent and then move to apparent authority. Based on the following facts and the totality of the circumstances found in this record, the clear and convincing evidence shows that Davis had actual authority to consent to the search of the appellant's computer. The appellant, Davis, and ANC Thacker were good friends who were stationed together at Hill Air Force Base, Utah. The record shows they trusted each other and decided to move out of the dormitories to an off-base apartment. All three airmen were listed as tenants on the lease, which began in May 2003. They each had a separate bedroom space in the apartment, and they each had a separate personal computer. A1C Davis appeared to be the most computer savvy among the three airmen. The appellant was making installment payments to Davis to buy a computer and had paid Davis some $300 of the $500 owed for the computer.
And what's the effect of that in our legal analysis as to determining whether there was common authority?
Yeah, I believe that would go more towards the apparent authority. I was really trying to outline the entire facts because I think that's important here to consider the totality of the facts in this case. But I would concede that's going to go more towards the apparent authority of Davis.
And by jumping off immediately on the authority aspect of this case, you have not addressed the expectation of privacy. Is it the government's position that since he had apparent or he had actual authority, that is just an area you don't need to deal with?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that it's case dispositive, but we do agree with the military judge that there was no subjective expectation of privacy by the appellant as to this computer under the facts of this case. Not in general concerning computers, but as to the facts of this case.
No subjective expectation of privacy as to that computer, as to his roommates, or as to the world in general?
As to the three airmen who shared that apartment, Your Honor. In the beginning, the appellant kept his computer in his own bedroom, but it crashed a short time later because his room didn't have air conditioning. It overheated, the computer crashed. The appellant purchased another hard drive and asked Davis to install it into the computer that Davis was selling to the appellant. They decided it was better to place the appellant's computer in Davis's own bedroom.
Because Davis' room was air-conditioned.
You're telling us the whole story, I know, but what are the key facts here? Do you agree with the appellant that the permission granted that day was for maintenance?
The explicit permission that day was stated to be for maintenance, yes, Your Honor. That is indeed in the record.
Okay. And is it your argument that based on that, Davis had sufficient authority or access to that computer then to consent to its search? Is that the key?
I wouldn't isolate that fact alone, Your Honor. I think you have to consider the totality of the facts that were present before the judge to come to that ultimate conclusion. If we take a single fact...
Which is why you're recounting the whole story.
Indeed, Your Honor. I think you have to look at the total picture to get to the bottom line here.
What... okay, well, that may be the answer to the next question, but how is this case, if at all, distinguished from, for example, when... two scenarios, when you invite someone to invite, when you ask the computer geeks to come to your house and fix your computer, does that mean you've now given them consent to bring the law enforcement with them as well? So they go in there, you say, I'm having trouble, you know, drawing up internet or whatever, and so they're like, hey, this is pretty handy, let's check out all the files.
Well, Your Honor,
and as long as we're here, we might as well call the police and invite them in the house as well.
Very different facts than what we have in this case, but if during the maintenance on my computer, the maintenance guys find images of child pornography and bestiality, I see nothing that would prevent them as a private citizen from reporting that to the police. I think
that's not what I'm asking, whether they would report it. I'm asking if they then can call the police and say, come on in. Do they have consent? Is that sufficient access to now consent to a search of your house, in fact, in your computer?
That fact alone would seem to be not enough, Your Honor. I think you would need more facts.
And what's the plus more here?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What's the more here?
The rest of the story in this case.
In particular, if you were writing the opinion and you said the following three facts were critical, or are you going to write an opinion saying... We're going to tell you the whole story and not tell you what was critical.
Well, I think there's more than three perhaps critical ones, but some of the most critical facts were this computer was sitting in Davis's own bedroom. I would argue Davis had greater access to the computer itself than...
So to take my analogy, you would then argue that this is not the case where you brought it to the house, brought the computer geeks to the house and said you've taken the computer to their office?
Again, if it's just a business transaction, I wouldn't equate that as being enough.
Okay.
By itself, we need more.
I'm sorry I interrupted you. You're telling me what else? You're giving your three critical facts.
The critical facts. The fact that it was sitting in Davis's own bedroom, and Davis actually had greater access to it for that reason, more time, if you will, than the appellant himself did. The fact that the appellant never password protected his own computer. He certainly had that ability, and I think that's acknowledged in the record. In fact, his words were, he didn't think it was required. Quite telling, I think. The fact that there was a local access network voluntarily established by the three airmen. They agreed to hook their computers up. They agreed to share their computers with one another. Like many young airmen, they're greatly interested in video games. That's what young airmen tend to be interested in.
Well, how does it play in that these particular files were not accessible on the LAN?
Well, Your Honor,
I mean, if they could share through the LAN, that's fine. They can share games, they can share whatever. But if these particular files were not accessible through the LAN, then what difference does the LAN make in this?
I think because, Your Honor, it demonstrates that they did have a willingness to share their computers with one another. There were several references in the record on this point, if I may. Davis stated at page 12... I set up the local area network in the apartment to use a router to allow the computers to communicate with each other, to play games and to share files. Davis at page 23, and this is in response to questions from the military judge,
in asking what was the reason for the land, you said that was the main reason when you talked about playing games. Was there any other reason? Yes, sir. To share files. The judge then went on, first off, let me ask you, were there any situations where you all shared music files? In other words, one of you said, geez, I've got this great song, and the other person says, you know, can I get to it? And then you just go into their files and download it onto their computer. Answer, yes, sir. Depending on the file settings, you can look at the files, but you can't move or copy them. If the file permissions are set, you can pretty much copy, paste, and create new files as you would on your own computer. I do acknowledge, as defense counsel pointed out on page 28, though, the issue isn't crystal clear because of what he said then on, I believe, recross examination concerning the music and the. But I don't think that the judge's finding of fact was in fact clearly erroneous in light of this testimony.
On the day in question, you said that he had specific permission to do maintenance. Is that how it was phrased, or can we tell from the record, or is it just that that's what he was going to do?
I think it was more that that's what he was going to do. The appellant reported to Davis that he was having additional problems with his computer, and he asked Davis to go into the computer to address it. Davis was at home on sick leave after recovering from some surgery while the appellant was at work, and that's when he went into the computer to do the maintenance and then ultimately found the images, Your Honor.
Were there any limitations whatsoever placed on his access to the computer on that day beyond the maintenance?
No, Your Honor. Not on that day or any day did the appellant communicate to Davis any restrictions, limitations, or objections to Davis's access to the computer or any portion thereof.
In terms of whether the findings of the judge were clearly erroneous, assuming that the judge's findings are all accurate as he stated them, why wasn't he also obligated to ascertain the relationship between those files that were on the network and those that were not? That is, it may be that my knowledge of computers is a sufficient level of sophistication, but I don't think I'm particularly sophisticated on this. I think most people who are on networks know that you basically have two types of files, those that are accessible to everybody who's on the network and those that remain on your C or other drive that aren't accessible. So why wouldn't the judge be obligated, in order to have findings that we could rely on here, to ascertain whether the seized files in this case were in one or the other?
Well, Your Honor, I would truly be in dangerous territory if I held myself out as a computer expert. I'm truly not.
Right. Not asking you to testify here, but just in terms of the evidence that was in the record alerting the judge to the existence of two types of files, those that were accessible through the network and those that were not. Without the judge having any special expertise, why would that information in the record be sufficient to alert him that he had to figure out, for purposes of findings of fact, where this particular file was located and then how that related to the expectations of privacy?
Well, Your Honor, that thing isn't explicitly addressed in the record. I agree with that. I can only speculate that he found the LAN relevant because it indicated an openness, a sharing among these three airmen, to the exclusion of the outside world, but among this small universe of these three airmen.
And is that the government's position here, that is, to the extent that we look at the LAN, it is only for that general atmosphere of openness and not for access to this particular file?
Well, I think from the record, I'd be hard-pressed to argue any further extension of the land.
Thank you. With respect to the bedroom, suppose that the situation was a little bit different from what we had here now, but to test the location of the seized item. When the appellant, suppose instead when the appellant purchased the computer, he wanted it in his room, and there was no room there's no space for it in the room unless he moved his personal dresser into Davis's room. So now Davis has the appellant's dresser in Davis's room. Does that give Davis access to the appellant's dresser? If there's just the mere placement in the room at that point, or does the appellant retain an expectation of privacy that simply because of lack of space he had to move the dresser into Davis's room, Davis would keep his hands off it?
Well, I think it would depend on what was communicated in the case, what kind of expectations, limitations, understandings, as we saw in this case. You'd have to look at those kind of facts, again, under the totality of the circumstances to determine the full extent and authority of the occupant of the bedroom who now has this dresser.
So if the appellant had said, well, let's share this bottom drawer that I'm not using, that's my, we'll call that my land drawer, we can share that, and you have particular carpentry skills, so if you see any of the pieces falling apart, you're welcome to fix my dresser for me. Does that give Davis the right to go into any of the other drawers when he's not fixing things, or going into the drawer that's not the land drawer at that point?
Your Honor, it would seem like we would be getting into the metaphysical subtleties of the Frazier case at that point if we're trying to compartmentalize the dresser drawer into subdivided areas of authority. I guess the bottom line is, as in Matlock, you have to look to determine whether the individual who's consenting to the search had that joint access, that mutual control of the space in question, such that the other individual assumed the risk that the consenter would in fact invite the police in to take a look. And that's our position here, is that the appellant did assume that risk. In light of everything that was done, in light of everything that was communicated or not communicated, this appellant assumed the risk that Davis would, in fact, invite the police in, as he did that day.
Thank you.
The record also reflects that Davis did regularly access the appellant's computer. It's not a case, as we saw in some of the other cases, where it was an isolated instance. He had regular access to to the appellant's computer for maintenance and for playing games. And this is supported by the testimony of Roman Thacker, which at first blush might not get as much attention as perhaps it should. Roman Thacker, the third roommate, testified through a stipulation of expected testimony that he used the appellant's computer at least once every day to play games, and that the appellant never supervised Thacker's use of the appellant's computer, that the appellant never restricted his access to the computer.
Now, wait a minute. Davis used it to play games, or Thacker did, or they both did?
They both did, from the record.
Why would Davis use the appellant's computer when he had a better, more powerful computer of his own?
That question is not answered in the record, but it is reflected that all three individuals accessed the appellant's computer to play games for whatever purpose. I'm not familiar with video games and why.
Nor am I.
Or the other, but the record shows they did do it, and Thacker said he did it every single day.
But to go back to the division we were talking about earlier, does the record, putting aside the question of maintenance, understand he had to actually physically go on to appellant Davis, he had to physically go on to appellant's computer to perform the maintenance. For any of these other purposes, does the record show us whether Thacker and Davis were accessing the computer by physically manipulating the keys on appellant's computer, or were they accessing it through the LAN? It appears that they're primarily talking about accessing it through the LAN.
Well, I thought it was actually on his computer directly. If I'm not mistaken, the appellant himself testified that there was a shortcut to the video games on his desktop and that that's how they were getting into the games. I believe the appellant himself so testified.
Okay, yeah, if you could point out in the record where it is that it's demonstrating that to play the games, they physically went on to his computer as opposed to accessing it through the LAN.
Yeah, sure. I would need a moment to do that.
Sure.
All right.
And if it's not readily accessible, you can continue with your argument.
Okay, Your Honor.
While you're doing that, just to test your multitasking, can you juggle your glasses while also answering this question? The appellant referred to common access as a critical legal standard or test. What language do you hope, or would you anticipate, or would you request this court adopt? Understanding you have your facts, and then what are we actually testing for here?
I believe we would need to rely upon the language in Matlock as the test to be applied here. And if I may have a moment, I'll...
And it's not fair for me to ask you to look up two things at once, so you're...
Sure,
I was hoping it might be at the top of your, on the tip of your tongue, but you can...
Matlock spoke of possessing common authority over or sufficient relationship to the premises.
So you would like us to, in your view, continue with that?
Yes, Your Honor. I think we have to, because more than one individual possessed this authority, both the appellant and, in our view, Davis. So I think the Matlock...
The appellant would say, well, common, that's precisely my point. It's not common. It may be authority, but it's not the same. And what's your response to that?
That it's not common under these facts, Your Honor? Well, obviously we contend that it is under the totality of everything in this case.
Okay. Sorry.
Yes, Your Honor.
That was fun.
Yes, Your Honor.
Would it have been any different if Thacker had done this instead of Davis?
Well, probably not, Your Honor. I think these three...
Even though it was sitting in Davis's room.
Even though it was in... I think the fact that it's in Davis's room really shows the lack of an expectation of privacy.
As regards Davis or as regards anybody?
Anybody in this universe of three, Your Honor.
You might be looking at referring to page 59 where they talked about the shortcuts, and I couldn't discern from the appellant's testimony on 59 as to whether there was a shortcut on each of their screens which allowed them to access appellant's material or whether they had to physically go to appellant's computer and do it. That wasn't clear to me from the record.
Yes, Your Honor. I'll confess I probably can't point to anything at the moment, but I would be glad to submit that to the court if you would.
If it's not a request, if there is something that you wanted to point to, of course, that's your option.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I didn't have any further questions on that. Thanks.
All right, Your Honor. Thank you. Based on the specific and express consent of Davis, that Davis received from the appellant that day, he did go into the computer when he was at home while the appellant was at work. And as Davis stated, they shared a similar taste in music. That's when, of course, he found the offending images in the appellant's My Music folder. Shocked by what he found, he then, of course, tried to call immediately his first sergeant. Wasn't able to reach him until the following Monday. OSI called Davis in Tuesday at 11. And I think it's important to note that the OSI did not rush to judgment. The record shows they interviewed Davis for several hours. They wanted to make sure they got it right here. There was no misconduct by law enforcement officials. They spent considerable and careful time with Davis to get to the bottom of the facts, to find out what happened, to find out the true extent of Davis's authority to look at this computer.
Counsel, if we agree with you that Davis had actual authority, do we need to even reach the apparent authority issue?
No, Your Honor. Indeed not. That's a fallback position.
And if we did reach the apparent authority issue, what weight do you, in your mind, should we give to the fact that the legal officer was consulted?
Well, as in Wright, and there were several other cases, it was significant that the law enforcement officials sought out legal advice and assistance.
addressing this question. Again, as part of their careful attempt to get to the bottom of this, they sought out legal help so that they were sure themselves they were on firm ground before they proceeded. They took Davis over to the legal office. This was an unusual step. I don't think you'll find this in other cases. They went the extra mile. They took him over to the JAG. The JAG personally interviewed Davis, talked about these same facts. And then, once the legal officer opined that Davis had authority, OSI, the JAG, and Davis go over to the apartment together. Once again, you won't find many JAGs accompanying the agents into the field. Again, reflecting a careful attempt to get this right. And so it is, it's relevant for that point to show that you don't have police misconduct here. Under the exclusionary rule, there's no misconduct to be deterred under the facts of this case. The police were doing a good job here and getting to the bottom of the consent question. There's also the pretext call, I would like to point out. It's worth mentioning because it confirms, I believe, in the appellant's mind, that he didn't believe he had an expectation of privacy or that he had withheld consent, authority to consent, as to Davis. Because when Davis called him at OSI's request, and Davis pointed out that he found these sick or nasty images on the appellant's computer, the appellant's reaction was, hey, wait a minute, what are you doing in my music folder? It was an acknowledgement that he had these images on his computer, that he got them during his mass download, and that he had intended to delete the ones he didn't want to keep, which reflects his true state of mind, his understanding of their relationship, and Davis's authority to go into that computer. So I think it's quite...
Or could it be like the government argues in other cases that he was so sophisticated in his understanding of his Article 31 rights that he decided that he better not say anything at that point?
Well, that's certainly possible, Your Honor. It's certainly possible. We would argue the other version, of course, but we like that it's certainly possible.
You just said something that, of course, raises a question in my mind. You said that he said that they had basically been accidentally mass downloaded to his computer. Have you reviewed his provenance inquiry?
I have, Your Honor.
And was he provenant to the fact that he knowingly and intentionally?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about that. No question about it, Your Honor. Finally, I guess I would point out, although this wasn't a fact that the judge relied upon in his findings of fact or conclusions of law, I think there's some relevancy to the appellant's own participation in OSI's eventual search of the computer. And I'm not here to argue that goes to the findings or the conclusions, but I think it again reinforces that this appellant had no expectation of privacy and wasn't surprised that his computer, in fact, was eventually consented to a search by OSI. OSI had already, while they were over at the apartment, OSI independently had brought the appellant to the OSI office, rights advised him, and the appellant was beginning to confess to his crimes to OSI, to different agents than the ones that were in the field. And he had agreed to point out to the OSI agents where the offending images were located on his computer, how he downloaded them. The team in the field returns to the OSI office with the computer. They put it in a different room, and then they bring Davis into that room, where Davis then voluntarily points out where the images are, explains how he downloaded them, identifies the particular images that he believed were of children engaged in sexually explicit conduct. And again, at that point, he never voiced any objection or concern that anybody had accessed his computer. I'm not arguing that supports the particular findings or conclusions of the judge, but I think it should let this court be further convinced that there was no subjective or reasonable expectation of privacy, and that Davis, in fact, had the authority to consent to a search of this computer. Your Honor, are there any other questions?
You may conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. Davis had actual authority to consent, and as I said, even if he certainly didn't, he had apparent authority that he communicated to OSI, and they reasonably relied upon that when they executed the consent search of the appellant's computer. His conviction should be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
I think I can shed a little bit more light on the issue involving the desktop or the shortcuts and the use of the computer to play games. The record on page 20, Aaron Davis talks about the fact that he didn't need to use Aaron Rader's computer to access the internet because his computer was faster and better. And that the only reason he ever got Aaron Rader's computer and turned at the bottom of the page was for the purpose of games and whenever he asked him to check something out. Looking also at the...
Counsel, I don't know what that means. I don't know whether got on the computer means that he physically accessed it or whether he accessed it through the LAN. Is there anything that tells us?
I think when you look again then at the record of 59, which you pointed out, and then Rader's testimony, I think what they did was load a computer game on a particular computer and then create a shortcut to it on the desktop. So if Aaron Davis wanted to play whatever the game was, and that game was loaded on Aaron Rader's computer, he would go into Aaron Rader's computer, open the desktop, click on that shortcut, which would then open that game. But he would never go into the individual files.
Wait a minute. Is he sitting in front of the computer in Davis's room, or is he sitting in his own room?
Well, both computers.
Well, they were both. Oh, yeah, to say Thacker.
I think.
Is Thacker sitting in Thacker's room doing this, or is he sitting in Davis's room doing this?
I think that if whatever game the computer was loaded on, they'd have to sit in front of that computer. So it would be.
So he'd have to be in Davis's room.
Sure.
Okay.
And I think what happened in. I'll admit also that it gets a little confusing.
Counselor, are you speculating here, or are you pointing to something in the record that tells us that Davis went to appellant's computer, physically touched it, and physically accessed files in it, or we don't know?
It is unclear. I think you can glean from it that all Davis would do would be to click on a shortcut if he is doing it from the computer, from Rader's computer. Those issues go to Davis's common use. And throughout his testimony, in response to cross-examination, questions from the judge, there is discussion on limitations where he's not, he says it's the first time I've ever accessed in my music folder. It's, I only use it for these particular purposes. And what the military judge should have seized on was, wait a minute, OSI seized and then searched this computer via a third-party consent. And if they're going to do it that way, it has to be done right in order for them to be able to avail themselves to the evidence. And here, the military judge should have drilled down further to make sure that it was, that those images were taken off of the main music folder, that the individual giving law enforcement access to those folders had the authority to do so. We maintain that he did not, and the military judge should have so found. We'd ask the court to set aside the findings and sentence in this matter. If there are no further questions, I conclude.
Thank you, counsel, and we thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will stand in recess until 5 minutes after 10 o'clock this morning. Thank you.
The court stands in recess for 5 minutes.
Good morning. Our second case today is United States against Lewis. This is a certified case, and the government may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I'm Judge Efron, members of the court. My name is Captain Adam Kazin. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Shell Shields, representing the United States as appellant in this matter. Rule for Court Martial 916E4 states an accused's right to self-defense is lost if the accused was an aggressor, a neutral combatant, or provoked the attack, unless the accused had first withdrawn in good faith. While the Army Court's decision in this case is consistent with this Court's recent decision in United States v. Deering, in that it allows escalation of conflict to replace the good faith withdrawal standard, that ruling is inconsistent with Rule for Court Martial 916E4 and longstanding federal common law practice. This Court should overturn the Army Corps' lower ruling and its decision in Deering and return the law of self-defense to the proper standard. Now, the issue has been raised by both appellee and amicus as to what is the proper source of authority concerning self-defense. Goodman would point out that on two occasions, this Court has specifically recognized that the law of self-defense is found in Rule for Court Martial 916E.
Counsel, does Rule for Court Martial 916E say anything at all about escalation?
No, it does not, Your Honor.
Does it say that the Court can't graft on to the rule additional judicially created exceptions?
It doesn't specifically say that, no, Your Honor.
And isn't it common in federal courts for judges to deal with statutory offenses and come up with defenses that are recognized in common law?
It is, Your Honor. However, the issue here is that the escalation of conflict concept is a deviation from federal common law practice. Also, the federal court system is going to be slightly different in that you do not have the president's rulemaking authority involved in that as well.
But you've agreed with me that the president's rule does not say anything about escalation. It does not specifically prohibit that factor, does it?
Well, Your Honor,
I guess what I'm just wondering is, why do you want to push us in that direction?
Well, Your Honor, what the government is asking for is the plain language analysis, that the analysis begin with the rule for court martial 916E4. It's not necessarily going to end there. However, again, we use reference by United States versus McNutt in our brief, that it starts with the language of the rule, and then the question then becomes is Deering an analysis of the withdrawal or is replacement? And in the case of United States versus Deering, then even going back to United States versus Cardwell, there's no analysis of how the escalation conflict concept touches upon the rule as it's written in the manual for force martial. It simply replaces it.
Well, the amicus brief talks about this whole notion of escalation and cites many cases. And I don't know if it was filed after you had a chance to file a reply brief, but are you suggesting that the amicus brief is misstating the holding in all the cases that it cited on this issue?
It certainly doesn't. It's overstating the standard. And touching on a couple of the cases, for example, the amicus cites People versus California, a California case of 1960. Actually, People versus Whitfield, a California case out of 1968. And amicus puts in the brief the parenthetical next to it that mutual combat means the contest was waged on equal terms and no undue advantage was taken by defendant. What the actual case says is, in a case of mutual combat where a homicide is committed, in order to reduce the offense from murder to manslaughter, it must appear that the contest was waged on equal terms and no undue advantage was taken by defendant. So it wasn't defining mutual combat. It was stating that in the case of a mutual combat, if the defendant wants to have the charge reduced to manslaughter, then it must be the fight must have been on equal terms and no undue advantage taken by the defendant, not the victim in that case. Also, two other cases cited by amicus, Jackson versus South Carolina case 2003. It specifically states in that case that a defendant is entitled to self-defense charge if there is evidence establishing, for one fact, he was without fault in bringing on the difficulty. In that particular case, the defendant's wife chased him out of their house with a gun, and that is probably as close to a good faith withdrawal as we're going to get. He was running away from her, and she chased after him with the gun. The only reason the court ended up actually not finding that there was self-defense in that case was because he shot her in the back. In Lynn versus Commonwealth, Virginia case in 1998, also cited by the appellant, the court in Virginia lays it out the difference between justifiable homicide and excusable homicide. And according to page 353 of that particular decision, justifiable homicide in self-defense occurs when a person, without any fault on his part in provoking or bringing on the difficulty, kills another under reasonable apprehension of death or great bodily harm to himself. If an accused is even slightly at fault at creating the difficulty leading to the necessity to kill, the killing is not justifiable homicide. And it goes on to state that excusable homicide is when the person was at fault in bringing about the difficulty, but then withdrew in good faith before he committed the final assault.
Let me ask you this question. In this case, as I understand, at least one version of the facts, the appellant is on the ground with one person sitting on top of him and his hands around his neck, and with another person kicking him in the head. How could he either physically withdraw or, under those circumstances, assuming that that's what was going on, signify his interest in withdrawing?
Well, and it was actually the appellant that had his arm around the victim's neck, not the other way around. It was Private Harvey on top of Private Lewis.
And someone kicking him in the head. Okay, so the guy's on the ground, one person's on top of him, another person's kicking him in the head.
Signaling withdrawal could be something as simple as yelling stop.
Okay, but that's what I'm asking, man. I'm trying to imagine, you know, having someone, one person sitting on me, another person kicking me in the head, and you want them, in order to get this defense, to be able to scream stop or get up and leave. And I'm just wondering, as a practical matter, how they're supposed to do that.
Well, if it was a case where they were prevented from withdrawing, I think that's...
But just to be clear, you've also given them the alternative of passing out. So that's the government's view as well in terms of how you withdraw from a fight as you pass out.
That was one example.
So I just want you to continue with that in mind as well as you answer the question.
Yes, sir. The government is not asking for a retreat as a definition of withdrawal. We're not saying that he has to get up and leave. He simply has to try to withdraw from the combat. And again, even an attempt at withdrawal at least keeps it within the rule that he is trying to somehow bring the level of violence down as opposed to continually escalating it. The whole point is that there must be some conduct on the accused part to cleanse himself of the original wrongdoing which caused him his right to self-defense in the first place.
But you didn't answer the question. So he's getting kicked in the head. And by the way, where in your brief does it get into all of that? Is Bryant involved in the fight in your brief?
Yes, he is, Your Honor.
Where? He shows up at the beginning there, but I don't see how you, if I'm in the right brief, I could be in the wrong brief since there's a lot in this case. But be that as it may, I don't see Bryant in your fight in your brief, by the way, but now he's appeared at oral argument.
Yes, sir.
Is Bryant relevant to this case?
He is irrelevant in that the government is not saying that the government is basically kind of giving up the argument that there was no escalation of conflict. I mean, for purposes of this argument, we're assuming it was escalated when Bryant entered into, and while we didn't address that in our brief, that factor, because...
So does that mean you think it's relevant, but you just didn't think you mentioned it in your brief? Or it's not relevant and we shouldn't consider it?
It's not relevant for the final analysis of whether or not there was a good faith withdrawal is required as opposed to escalation of conflict.
So just to be clear in response to Judge Ryan's question, the question here is whether he should have had an instruction, not whether he was entitled to actually stab the guy, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so in the government's view, it is indeed the government's position that the way to withdraw from this particular fight was to either do what? Pass unconscious?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. The issue here is that there was no evidence of a withdrawal or an attempt to withdraw or desire to withdraw, which is why no instruction...
And the members should not have been addressed that question.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
And that was not an issue for the members to consider.
The escalation of conflict, Your Honor, or the fact that...
Whether he had the opportunity to withdraw or not.
Well, the judge in that instruction said that a person that is engaged in mutual combat can regain the right to self-defense through a good faith withdrawal. She did not give the more specific instruction in the military judge's bench book. I believe it's note 7 of that particular section where it discusses good faith withdrawal in more detail. But the military judge did lay out the specific standard for mutual combatants and aggressors, and that's on... It's in the judge's instructions... find it specifically, Your Honor. The judge specifically instructed that a person who is a neutral combatant loses the right to self-defense unless they withdraw in good faith first.
But you're suggesting that withdrawal is not required.
Well, the withdrawal is not required.
I guess my question is, are you asking us to interpret the rule or to apply had withdrawn those two words in their strict grammatical sense?
Well, not necessarily a strict ironclad grammatical sense, in the sense that the standard is a good faith withdrawal. However, the court's power to interpret it requires that it be a reasonable application of that rule. The government's not asking for that absolute stringent, that's what the actual words say. It's what it's asking for is that the requirement be based out of that rule. Whether there is a possibility that he was prevented from withdrawing. Well, if he was prevented from withdrawing, it means that he was attempting to withdraw or trying to withdraw, trying to decrease the level of violence. And in that case, and that is essentially what they're trying to argue at trial, is that he was prevented from withdrawing. Prevented from withdrawing is a different thing than escalation of conflict because it changes the focus. The focus of good faith withdrawal has always been on the behavior of the accused. He did something wrong to lose his right to self-defense, and he must do something to regain that right to self-defense. It's not what the other party does, it's what he's doing.
So you want us to read the rule to say, unless the accused had attempted to withdraw or had signaled an intent to withdraw or something of that fashion.
Something, yes, well, again, something closer to the rule. Again, what we're asking for
purposes
of an analytical framework is starting with the rule and interpreting from there. The escalation of conflict is simply something that's not found in federal common law practice. It was sort of grafted in Cardwell out of language from Acosta Vargas and from U.S. versus Straub. But both of those cases dealt with, they didn't deal with mutual combatants. In both those cases, the issue was what amount of force may someone use in self-defense if they're rightfully exercising self-defense.
In the, you've also referred to, in the case of mutual combatant, as someone engaging in wrongful conduct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's your view that any individual who engages in any sort of mutual touching in the military that's unwanted by either party without any indication as to who touched first, that person's guilty of an offense?
No, Your Honor. Specifically, that if someone starts a fight with someone, if person A initiates a fight with person B and person B is fighting back, that's not necessarily going to be a mutual combatant. And there's some of the cases talk about that if you're challenged to a fight and you have no choice but to continue fighting, you're not a mutual combatant. In this case, we're assuming that the parties are mutual combatants for purposes of this argument, that both parties are wrongdoers and both parties in this particular situation are co-aggressors, if you will.
A mutual combatant then has committed an offense unless that person can demonstrate that he or she is not the person who struck first. So in that case, do we have a situation in military law where we would now require someone to prove their innocence?
No, Your Honor.
So where is the wrongdoing in a situation where you have mutual combatants and you can't identify who started it?
Well, the point is that is actually a question of fact that is laid out to the jury. Because the instruction given to the jury was that he may be a mutual combatant. That is a question of fact. Did one person start it? Did the other person start it? Did they both start it together?
But your earlier argument was that a person who is engaged in mutual combat is a wrongdoer.
If they are a mutual combatant, Your Honor, yes, but they may not necessarily be a mutual combatant simply because they're fighting. If a fight is initiated by one party against the other party's will, and they are fighting back in self-defense, they're not a mutual combatant.
What offense, what is the offense of engaging in mutual combat?
Well, it's an assault, Your Honor. Is one person assaults another. A mutual combat is not started until someone has physically done something.
So someone who's engaged in mutual combat has committed an assault, even if they're responding to someone else.
Not if they're responding, Your Honor.
So the burden is on them to prove the response?
No, the burden is on the government to prove that they're the burden is actually on the government. The government must prove that PSC Lewis was not a mutual combatant, or was a mutual combatant, in order for this instruction to... The burden never shifts to the accused. The burden is that the law places that when if you are a mutual combatant, which the government must prove, you've lost the right to self-defense.
So that a person who's involved in a mutual combat with no escalation can be guilty of assault?
Yes, Your Honor.
Who are the mutual combatants here?
Mutual combatants here were Private Harvey, Private Harvey, Private Lewis, and Private Ryan, and Mr. Ryan.
But you didn't mention that in your brief. So the government's view is that the Bryant is or is not part of the mutual combat?
Well, we agree that the mutual combat. Unfortunately, the facts are there's a lot of different witnesses of who started the fight between. The physical fight initially started between Harvey and Bryant. Bryant jumped in at one point, and then Trexler jumped in on Bryant at another point. So it's a melee, Your Honor, is probably the best word to describe what was happening here.
So if you take the appellant's version of the facts, is it fair to say that there was mutual combat followed by a different fight or not?
No, Your Honor, I'd say it's all part and parcel of one fight. I don't think it's...
What's the mutual part about two-on-one?
Well, the mutual is the agreement to commit violence against one another. It's not... There's no evidence that there was ever...
It's just an agreement to fight, so one person could take on 10, and it's mutual as long as they say, this looks reasonable.
It's possible. I mean, the experience of human... fighting, one person could decide to pick a fight with two.
So is it the government's view that the appellant knew when this fight started that he was in a fight against Bryant and I forgot the other guys, the other person?
Harvey.
The
appellant certainly knew that there were two people standing in front of him when he started the fight.
And it's your view that there was no evidence which might lead to a different factual conclusion that the member should consider?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The only reasonable conclusion, there is no evidence suggesting a different scenario.
No, there's lots of evidence. There's various scenarios, Your Honor. And again,
why shouldn't the members have had that put before them, that we were really dealing with two fights?
Well, I think the military judge instructed that there was the assault on Harvey, and then there was the later assault on Bryant. He was actually acquitted of the assault on Bryant. But whether or not, the defense counsel said it's more situational than it is individually, whether or not he had one self-defense standard against Harvey and a different self-defense standard against Bryant. The question is whether or not, and fundamentally the question is whether or not he brought this trouble upon himself so that he could now claim that he was stabbing people in self-defense. He committed it was as much his fault as it was Harvey's that this entire fight got started. That's the mutual combat part is essentially conceded for both sides that this was mutual combat. The question is whether or not Bryant's involvement...
So you're saying that's the only factual conclusion one could draw from the facts, whether you take appellant's version of the facts or the government's?
At this stage, yes, Your Honor.
That's your view.
Because we're arguing whether or not the escalation of conflict, which is a sort of subset of the whole mutual combatancy, is required to be instructed to the members.
So just as a hypothetical, so if another car drives up at this and they all jump in, is that a continuation of the mutual combat or is that a new altercation?
It could be a continuation of the combat's already started. Again,
how would that be a continuation?
Again, if they're part of the fight, I mean, it's hard to say factually, Your Honor, in that the question is not whether or not he's a mutual combatant at that point. The question now is whether or not he can withdraw in good faith. Now, if he's prevented from withdrawing in good faith, there's certainly an argument there that he has revived his right to self-defense. But it's not the escalation of the level of force in and of itself that revives his right to self-defense. That's certainly a factor in it, and maybe his motive for deciding to withdraw.
Does he remain a mutual combatant vis-a-vis the new car?
He can, Your Honor. I mean, that's part of the problem is that...
So he's stuck. Once he's a mutual combatant, it doesn't matter what happens, as far as the government's concerned.
That's actually not our position. Our position is he absolutely has a means of regaining his right to self-defense, and that is the good faith withdrawal standard.
But what if he can't?
Well, and again, that goes back to the good faith withdrawal does not equal a retreat to the wall, a standard that has been rejected in both federal common law and in federal and military jurisprudence. Retreat to the wall implies that he has to run away or get away.
What if he can't get away and he can't speak out, but he hasn't passed out?
Well, again, the question is whether or not there's any evidence to support that he was prevented from withdrawing. If he can find, if there's evidence to support that point of view, that he was prevented from withdrawing or desired to withdraw but couldn't do it, he certainly has an argument that good faith withdrawal has been met. The problem with Appelli's argument is that there was no evidence of any desire to withdraw, attempt to withdraw, or any facts that an inference of withdrawal could be raised. And so we've switched now to this escalation of conflict standard, which now just states that regardless of what the appellee does, if there's an escalation of the level of force, that by operation of law revives his right to self-defense. And the inquiry, though, should be is going back to that good faith withdrawal standard, whether or not he did something that cleansed him of his original wrongdoing.
Getting back to that wrongdoing, which case stands for the proposition that if two service members are engaged in a fist fight, both of them can be prosecuted for assault?
I went to United States versus O'Neill, Your Honor. Says that both parties to a mutual combat are wrongdoers, and the law of self-defense cannot be invoked by either so long as it continues in the combat. And that is United States versus O'Neill.
And they were both prosecuted in that case.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
They were both prosecuted?
Yes, Your Honor. And the question of the prosecution, again, whether or not Harvey should have been prosecuted is a separate issue. The government's original then theory at trial was that the accused was initiated the fight and that it was not Harvey's fault. At this stage, we have to concede that they were mutual combatants, that is, that they are both wrongdoers.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
You had earlier said that Lewis had started this fight in the course of your argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
Prior to that, you had said that an individual is can legitimately respond if they are threatened with harm.
Correct, Your Honor.
In this case, as I understand the record, Harvey cocked his arm in readiness to appear to hit Lewis. Now, is Lewis supposed to sit there and get hit and then he can respond?
Well, the question there is whether or not, I mean, if the panel believed that fact, that the accused was responding to a fist being cocked at him, that he was acting in self-defense from the inception, then he's not a mutual combatant, and none of this is necessary because he's not a mutual combatant from the outset. However, if the panel were to believe that that did not happen, that it was a mutual combat, that is, they both decided that either he was an aggressor or a mutual combatant, then we get into the further inquiry as to did he do anything to revive his right to self-defense.
But if your theory now is that they were mutual combatants, and if the evidence is conflicting as to who started the fight, does that matter at all?
Not for purposes of this inquiry, Your Honor.
Okay, but you have been arguing that today, and I just want
to... Yes, Your Honor,
and
I am starting from the position that they are mutual combatants, because that is the question is whether or not this escalation of conflict instruction must be given when a mutual combatant instruction is given.
Okay, I want to shift gears a little bit. Yes, is it the government's position that affirmative defenses are not substantive law?
No, Your Honor, the government, this court has said many times that affirmative defenses are based in substantive law, but the rules as promulgated are simply promulgating the rules as laid out in the substantive law. That the president is bound under Article 36 to apply the principles of law as practiced in the district courts of the United States, and he is bound by that substantive law. The president cannot fashion new substantive law on his own. He must apply as Article 36 lays out. That is an express limitation of the president's power, and the government recognizes that.
So what is he doing in 916E4?
Well, that is actually,
is that substantive law or is that procedural law?
Well, it's the promulgation of the law as practiced in federal district court. Going back to Roe versus U.S., United States, then if you look at the D.C. Circuit appeals court opinions in United States versus Grover, United States versus...
But if it is a reflection of those laws, you would agree that it's substantive law? If it deals with an affirmative defense.
It does deal with substantive law, yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Is it your position then, what's he doing here? I better repeat what Judge Erdman just said. What's he doing here? He, the president. Is he making substantive law, in which case you're saying reverse all our precedents and say he doesn't have an authority? Are you saying he isn't purporting to do it here, or what?
He is not purporting to make substantive law, Your Honor. The substantive law, again, and all of the rules...
And remember, 36 also gives him an out. He is not bound to the laws as enforced in the district court.
Well, it requires that there's the as practicable language.
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, go ahead.
And again, if the president is going to change the rule and say as practicable, then there's certainly has to be evidence and sort of justification for it. And this court's review, this court has struck down provisions of willful court martial 916 before, specifically Ellis versus Jacob, when the court found that there was a specific, the president overstepped his bounds and was going contrary to the rule as adopted by Congress. And again, the court never said that the president could not lay out the rules for court martial 916, which covers the affirmative defenses, nor would it ever say that these were not binding on the service members. Simply stated that the president could not create new substantive law in contradiction to what Congress had already done.
Wait a minute. Is the standard that the president can't contravene a statute, or is the standard that the president cannot make substantive law? Go back to Hudson and Goodwin. That's almost 200 years ago when the Supreme Court held that there is no federal common law of crime, that Congress had to do it.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. What's the president doing here?
Well, in this case, the president is doing is taking what, because there are no statutory affirmative defenses other than the two that Congress has touched upon, the question is where do affirmative defenses come from? Well, affirmative defenses, there is a adoption, I'm almost done if I can finish answering your question.
Yes.
Take your time. Answer the question at your own speed.
The president is promulgating rules because the federal courts have recognized affirmative defenses, even though there are no statutory affirmative defenses in federal practice, except I think for two. So what the president has done is he's gone to essentially taken the federal common law standard as practiced in the district courts of the United States and promulgated rules consistent with that practice. It's the principles of law that the president is supposed to apply as practiced, unless they're not impracticable. And those usually tend to touch on military exigencies that don't exist in a case like this, or in most cases concerning self-defense. The question is what is the president doing? He's promulgating a rule. It's probably a cross between a rule of procedure and a mode of proof, in that he is stating this is what the government must prove. The government must disprove these defenses. That is the government's burden. And again, this court has recognized in both Martinez and Salisbury that specifically that the law of self-defense is found in RCM 916. So in order for the reasoning that the president does not have the power to create these rules, we'd have to go back and we'd have to overrule Martinez, we'd have to overrule Salisbury, because they all started with the proposition that the rules concerning self-defense are laid out in the manual for courts martial.
Let me ask our chief, if I may.
Go ahead.
Okay, follow up.
Yes, sir.
Then is it your position that these are not substantive rules, or are you saying essentially that the president may do anything he wants to as long as it doesn't contravene a statute?
No, I want to be clear that the substantive procedural dichotomy is a little misleading, because certainly it touches upon substantive law. The president cannot make substantive law, but he certainly can make rules, prospective rules, based on substantive law. Now, sometimes he does it out based on the statute, as we have the case of RCM 916K, which promulgates the rules out of Article 50A concerning mental responsibility. And those rules, in that case, that rule can contravene because there's a specific statute on point. Regarding the other rules of affirmative defenses, including self-defense, the president is limited under the terms of Article 36, which states that his rules must apply the principles of law as practiced in the federal district courts, which happens to be, in this case, the American version of common law self-defense. And those are the right and left limits for the president's rule. If this court deems that the president has stepped outside his bounds and has done something either as promulgated the rule that he does not have the power to promulgate, or as promulgated outside of the principles of law as practiced in the federal district court, then the court should strike down that provision of RCM 916 directly, as it's done before again in the case of Ellis versus Jacob.
Thank you.
You'll have an opportunity on rebuttal to address further questions. Counsel for the defense.
May it please the court. I'm Captain Frank Ulmer, and Colonel Stephen Hendricks and I represent Pierce and Lewis, the appellee in this case. In the broadest sense, the issue certified by the Judge Advocate General of the Army is about presidential authority and the proper interpretation of Article 36. And should the court reach that issue, it should hold that the president does not have the power to prescribe the substantive law of self-defense.
Do you think the court should reach that issue?
No, Your Honor. That's really the broadest issue. This court can actually harmonize RCM 916E4 and the concept of escalation of the conflict explicitly to the extent it doesn't feel it's done so already.
And how would the court do that? Explain that.
Your Honor, contrary to the government's plain language argument, the rule from the President's rule and this court's principle of escalation of the conflict correspond together because the principle of escalation of the conflict corresponds to the general principle of withdrawal, reviving the right to self-defense. Now, what 916E4 does is it sets a condition for, in this case, a mutual combatant to regain the right to self-defense, and that condition is withdrawal. Now, for the rule to make any sense at all, it has to be read to presume the ability to safely withdraw in the first place. The escalation of the conflict principle accounts for those situations where a mutual combatant cannot meet the condition.
Or may not be able to.
Or may not be able
to. You can have escalation where they could still be able to.
You could. Yes, Your Honor. And even though the government says that retreat to the wall isn't necessarily required, the government's position does create a dangerous hurdle to the recipient of an escalation of force in that it almost creates a de facto requirement that the recipient of this escalation pause at his own peril to reevaluate the circumstances and determine whether withdrawal is even an option. And this obligation, of course, would have is not affected at all by the intentions of the person who has already escalated the conflict.
What evidence in this record is there that this the appellant could or could not withdraw or indicate an intention to try to withdraw?
There's nothing explicitly in the record, Your Honor, that indicates he tried to voice an intention to withdraw. However, the facts can lead to the conclusion that a reasonable inference from the facts that he could not withdraw, and that's because under one version of the facts, he was on the ground, pinned to the ground by Harvey and being kicked in the head by Mr. Bryant. So the facts could lead a reasonable panel to conclude that he could not withdraw in this case.
Counsel, I'd like to go back to a question I was exploring with the government, and that is in the case of a mutual combatant where there's no evidence as to who started the offense and only talking about simple assault, what case have you found that stands for the proposition that both individuals can be prosecuted for assault and convicted of assault in the military?
I'm not aware of one, Your Honor.
Does O'Neill stand for that proposition?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. I'm not sure that O'Neill actually talks about whether...
A simple assault, not an escalation case.
I don't believe that O'Neill actually says the other party to the mutual combatancy could be prosecuted for assault. Even under the plain language analysis that the government advances, the court should not construe the rule in a way that leads to an arbitrary result. To say that once a mutual combatant engages in a fight, he forever loses the right to self-defense would be arbitrary if within that analysis you were never to account for the ability to withdraw at all. Now, in fact, the government has advanced the argument that this court has never construed the escalation of the concept principle in light of RCM 916E4. Explicitly, maybe not, but at least in Deering, this court did seem sensitive to the fact that Deering himself was unable to withdraw due to the escalation of the conflict when it was discussing that principle. The court used language such as Deering was precluded from arguing that he had no choice but to defend himself against the escalating violence. And the court also used language such as Deering was not in a position to retreat because of the attack.
In fairness, if you're arguing legal policy and construing an arbitrary result, one could craft fact patterns that go both ways. Wouldn't you want a rule that would encourage people to stop fighting?
Yes, Your Honor, certainly. However, a rule...
So one could argue as well that it's an arbitrary result to, once you're in, you're in, rather than encourage people to try and withdraw.
Right, Your Honor. However, if if that were the policy that you just wanted to discourage people from fighting in the first place, then there would be no need to provide for a way to regain the right at all, and that is withdrawal. In other words, the rule could be, as you're pointing out, once you're in it, you're in it. Doesn't matter if you try to withdraw. Withdrawal doesn't matter. As a matter of policy, once you start a fight, once you engage in a fight, you forever lose the right to self-defense. But the fact that the rule itself contemplates a way to regain that right, once that's part of the rule, then this court should construe it in a way that makes sense when you're talking about withdrawal and the ability to do that. Now,
do we do it in terms of the, would you say, is it your view that we do it in terms of what is meant by withdrawal or by what's meant by mutual combatant?
Your Honor, first, I think in this case, it comes out the same either way. The court could craft an opinion that said, depending on the facts of the case, this is how you instruct the panel. In other words, the judge could instruct on both ways, under our argument and under the argument the amicus makes, which would be that, for instance, an instruction could be something like, there is some evidence in this case that although once engaged in mutual combat, the accused, when the escalation of the force occurred, no longer remained a party to that mutual combat. Or, in the alternative, there's some evidence that although he was engaged in mutual combat, the escalation of the force prevented him from withdrawing. Either way, Your Honor, it comes out the same way. Now, turning to the broader issue in this case, should the court decide to reach it, the government essentially argues that Article 36 requires the president to apply the principles of law from federal district courts to courts martial under his rule promulgation authority. But they really fail to answer the antecedent question in this case, which...
Let me ask you an antecedent question, which is, I've heard the word substantive versus procedural bandied about in the briefs, and I'm wondering if you can give me a brief summary of what distinguishes something that's substantive from something that's procedural, because based on certain definitions of substantive, I would say that huge parts of the rules for court-martial under that definition would be invalid and not permitted under Article 36. So, I mean, is that what you all are asking us to do, to say that the president has created a huge body of invalid rules?
No, Your Honor, I think this court is well suited to evaluate these on a case-by-case basis. And first off here, I think this court has previously said self-defense clearly is a matter of substantive law. But in terms of...
But I just want a general definition of what appellants, of what... your position is as to what a substantive rule or law would be.
Okay, Your Honor, and taking in light of the definition of pretrial, trial, and post-trial procedures from Article 36, those would be the rules that provide for the means of getting to trial, that once you're at trial, that ensure the smooth administration of the trial, and post-trial would essentially the same thing apply to the smooth administration of the post-trial process. Substance, on the other hand, is what actually what happens at trial, not what administers the trial, but what the trial is about.
Okay, so Rule 907, grounds for dismissal, would that be a substantive rule?
Grounds for
And what about 704, grants of immunity, or 707, dismissal for speedy trial? I mean, aren't those all, in some sense, touching on what happens to the accused at trial?
Yes, Your Honor,
I don't know the answer. I'm asking you because I'm not really hearing anything that seems that workable.
Yes, Your Honor, and the reason I really didn't address the difference in the general sense is because of this court's clear holdings in prior cases that self-defense, which of course is the issue in this case, is substantive law. On a broader scale, Your Honor, I'm not aware of this court's precedent one way or the other that addresses those particular areas. Again, however, as this court has held in the past, self-defense is a matter of substantive criminal law. And it's also well established that the president cannot prescribe substantive law. Now, the government takes issue with our position that common law obviously does play a role in law in the military. The government says explicitly in their reply brief that Congress, by statute, creates the law for the military. Well, they also, in the brief, concede that the law of self-defense, or excuse me, that the president cannot prescribe the substantive law. So if self-defense is not statutory, it's not a statutory defense, which the government concedes, then the question becomes, where does it come from, and how can it ever apply at all in courts martial under the government's construction of the rule?
So do you think that if self-defense is a substantive law, presumably because it's a defense, is that the reason?
Well, that's... Yes, Your Honor, that is one way to define what a substance is.
So would all of the defenses listed in 916 then be improper?
No, Your Honor, and there's nothing, and to be clear, we're not saying that it's improper necessarily for the president to promulgate these rules. He certainly has the authority to promulgate a rule. The question becomes then whether it is the extent of the law, if it is the extent of the rule. And frankly, the rule as it's written, it doesn't necessarily improperly state the general principles of self-defense. It's just that it doesn't account for the entire extent of the substantive law of self-defense as defined by this court. So
what we do is we engage in interstitial rulemaking around what the president says, regardless of whether it's substantive or procedural?
No, Your Honor. The fact that it's in the RCMs, not all RCMs are created equal, I guess is what I'm saying. And if the RCM is clearly within the president's authority under Article 36 to promulgate, then that could be viewed as the extent of the law. That's what the president said under his authority under Article 36. To the extent that he speaks beyond his authority as delegated by Congress, then it's merely an advisory statement.
Why is that the case? President of the United States... He has the authority to regulate the armed forces as commander-in-chief, except perhaps to the extent limited by Congress. So if the president promulgates a rule, whether it's in the rules for courts martial or the Part 4 on the elements, isn't that binding on all members of the executive branch? That is, if the president says... And I'm recalling now our cases dealing with the exculpatory no doctrine. Didn't we say in those cases that the president can bind all the officials of the executive branch as to how they prosecute cases, irrespective of what effect it might have on defendants? That is, that the defendants may be able to argue that authority goes beyond the president's authority, but executive branch officers can't. They have to follow it. And so if in those rules the president gives defendants more rights than they would otherwise have, isn't that binding on everybody in the executive branch?
Yes, Your Honor, that's true.
So it's not merely advisory at that point, is it?
It's not, but that's distinguishable because as this court pointed out in a case like Davis, normally what the president says in the realm of substantive law is not going to bind this court. However, as the court said in Davis, this court will choose to abide by the president's interpretation should he interpret it in a way that provides more rights to the service member.
So is that your answer to Judge Ryan's question, which I take it as basically saying, do we have a big hole here? You know, if Congress hasn't spoken and the president has spoken but exceeded his authority, then where are we?
In terms of specifically self-defense, Your Honor?
Well, I'm talking about not necessarily don't limit it to self-defense. The president hasn't Congress hasn't spoken. Congress is silent. The president has purported to promulgate a rule that says ABC, but it's a substantive rule. What do we do?
We're left with the common law then, and as the government concedes traditionally, the common law defenses are used for federal statutory crimes. And that's in fact right where we are in this case. And One way to view the rule and how it ended up in the RCMs in the first place is that it's a rule derived from the common law, and it just doesn't, as any rule,
it's declaratory of the common law.
Yes, yes, Your Honor, but it's not the extent of it.
It's declaratory of a portion of the common law.
Yes, Your Honor. In summary, the government has failed to put forth any reason why this court's precedent from Caldwell and Deering suffers from any infirmity, and as such, this court should affirm the decision of the Army Court.
Thank you, counsel. Does the government have rebuttal?
In recognition that the government does bear some burden in trying to get this court to overrule a decision it's made 5 months ago, we should lay out the reasons why we think Deering is an unworkable and flawed decision as well as Caldwell. Particularly, there's 3 points really on why Deering just doesn't work. First, it applies United States versus Caldwell without first addressing RCM 916E4 in the analysis. If the law of self-defense is found in the manual for court-martial, as stated in Martinez and as stated in Salisbury, it should be part of the analysis. Where does escalation fit in? The second one...
So, wait, to be clear, are you saying then the concept of one of appellant's argument, one of that side's arguments was that you could harmonize 916 with the concept of escalation, and you're saying there is no, you can't get there from here. This is not a factual dispute, this is a legal dispute, that escalation is inherently inconsistent with this rule, period.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, well, let's test that.
Yes, Your Honor.
I think you said something different earlier. Hypothetical. Private pistol and private blade. They're engaged, words are exchanged, as happens from time to time. Nobody knows who used the first words.
What's wrong?
Wrestling starts, as happens from time to time in the military. Nobody knows who starts it first. Pistol then puts a gun right between Blade's eyes and says, now you're going to get what you deserve. As I understand what you said earlier, and maybe there's some limits on this. The question is, at that point, is there even an opportunity to withdraw? So my question is, at that point, Blade's sitting there with a pistol between his eyes. Does he have to pull out his manual for courts martial and decide whether he's going to ask to withdraw, or can he use that knife that's in his pocket to defend himself?
In that case, I would say he could use his knife. Well, I would have to combat it, Your Honor, in that is an example of perhaps the prevention of withdrawal, that he could not withdraw because he has a gun to his head. And in that case,
even though the rule itself says had withdraw, the rule says he has to withdraw.
Right.
Here, he can't withdraw. That pistol's between his eyes.
So he can still withdraw from the combat, even though he has not withdrawn from physically the individual with him.
Oh, he's going to engage in a discussion then with Blade's going to engage in a discussion with Pistol and say, well, let's talk about this first?
Not at all, Ron. We're not saying these are the governing rules for a fight. We're saying this is a question of who is going to be held responsible for what conduct later. The question is now is it's a question of responsibility. And
Now what's happened in that case is with the gun between his eyes, Blade pulled out his blade and struck and saved himself. So what's the president tell us we're supposed to do then as a court in terms of instructing members as to what they should decide in this case?
If the accused can formulate an argument that states, and this is for purposes of instruction, if he can state that he withdrew or attempted to withdraw or committed some sort of withdrawal act or thought or feeling, and
that he didn't think anything in that case. He heard, now you're going to get what you deserve, and he pulled out his knife and he used it. That's the evidence of the case. Is the government's view then that he's guilty?
It's possible, Your Honor.
It's possible then. Doesn't that then go into a question that's instructed to the members for them to decide?
I think that the members could be instructed that the standard is still a good faith withdrawal, and that they would be left to whether or not there was facts in that scenario that constituted a good faith withdrawal so that he could now employ deadly force.
So if his testimony is, I had a gun between my eyes. I pulled out a knife and used it. He doesn't have any entitlement to instruction. When on cross-examination, the trial counsel says, what were you thinking? And he says, I wasn't thinking anything. I pulled out the knife and I used it.
Again, Your Honor, because he brought that fight amongst him, upon himself, not saying he's irrevocably committed to the fight, but again, both calling on the way back to federal common law precedent, good faith withdrawal is still the standard.
Okay, so that's the government's view, that if there's a mutual fray, low-key, words are exchanged, person has a pistol between his eyes, he can't defend himself.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And again, this going back to the sort of the unworkable of Cardwell and Deering is that it goes beyond what is stated out in federal common law. We certainly, the military judges are certainly required to instruct, tailor their instructions to fit the facts, but they don't tailor the law to fit the specific facts. And the law is, as we stated out, whether it's you're going to federal common law, going back to Roe or back to O'Neill, or whether you take it from the rule for court martial 916E4, always out the good faith withdrawal standard. And that is the standard of law. And the judge instructs on the law, she tailors it to the facts, but they do not specifically instruct on the possible theories that might arise. I see I've run out of time. If there's any further questions,
please feel free to conclude. Or to answer Judge Baker's question.
So you are happy with an instruction that says the members can consider whether by fair inference an accused attempted to withdraw?
Yes, Your Honor.
An accused attempted to withdraw.
We'd be comfortable with an instruction like that, yes, Your Honor. And I realize that it's not the absolute plain language. We've asked for a plain language analysis. But certainly, we certainly don't want to say that the court does not have the power to interpret the law, interpret the rules, but that the issue...
You would view that instruction as consistent with the president's rule?
Certainly. I think it would be consistent with the president's rule and with the federal common law precedent of requiring an accused to do something to cleanse himself of his withdrawal, of his initial wrongdoing.
You may conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. The government is not asking the court to change the law or to set it right. The exercise of self-defense is long required that the accused be free from fault in bringing the trouble upon himself. In the context of a mutual combatant, an accused cleanses himself of his wrongdoing through a good faith withdrawal. Rule for court martial 916E4 is the proper standard to apply in courts martial, and its plain language should be adhered to. The instructions given by the military judge in this case concerning the loss of self-defense correctly related the legal standard as promulgated through RCM 916E4. The Army Court's decision in this case, United States v. Deering and United States v. Cardwell, should be overturned. The government asks this court to answer the certified issue in the affirmative. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And we thank counsel for both sides for your presentation today. The case is now submitted. The court will recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.
The court stands in recess until...